She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everyone. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and this is indeed Mrs. Green's World. We are committed to doing the good thing, the right thing, not just for ourselves, but for all beings who call the earth home. And we thank you for listening and for being a part of our world. At this point in the show, I always do a big shout out and thanks to the sponsor of the show. In this case, it's a very valued partner of Mrs. Green's World, Tucson Medical Center. For over 70 years, members of our community have counted on TMC to be here for us when we are at our most vulnerable. They have been entrusted with this legacy, and they continue the tradition of improving the health and well-being of the people of Southern Arizona in almost every possible way that I can think of, from prevention to all of their incredible hospice programs and everything in between, and they take care of our community. We appreciate them and all of the important work they do in this community. For more information about TMC, please visit them at tmcaz.com. We have yet another important and impactful show today, and it's a topic that seems to make the national news almost daily. For this next hour, we're going to be taking an in-depth look at the opioid crisis. Every day, more than 115 Americans die after overdosing on opioids. The misuse of and addiction to opioids, including pain relievers, heroin, and synthetic opioids, is a serious national crisis that affects public health as well as the social and economic well-being of millions. It is arguably one of the most dramatic, complicated, and frightening crises facing our country today. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that the total economic burden of prescription opioid misuse alone in the United States is about $78.5 billion a year, including the costs of health care, lost productivity, addiction treatment, and criminal justice involvement. Joining me in studio are two doctors who do know a great deal about this complex issue and who'll shed some light on how it started, how we got here today, and what's being done about it. Join me in welcoming Dr. Robin Cloth and Dr. Nisan Marietta from Old Pueblo Anesthesiology in Tucson, Arizona. Dr. Cloth received her medical degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, completed her residency at the University of Virginia Health System, and is certified by the American Board of Anesthesiology. Dr. Marietta received her medical degree from the University of Missouri Columbia School of Medicine, and completed her residency at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. You know what? It's wonderful to have you both back.
Thanks for having us.
Last time you were on, it was not enough time, so many more questions, and thank you. You're both really busy, and I appreciate your coming back to talk about such an important issue. So, of course, the most obvious question is, I think, the best way to start. What is an opioid? It's used, and if you quizzed most people on the street, I don't think they would be able to answer.
There's a lot of confusion in the terminology about opioids, narcotics. Opioids refers to specifically a derivative of the opium poppy, opium itself, and its analogs. So natural analogs like morphine and codeine, and synthetic analogs, fentanyl and carfentanyl, and some of the other things that we've been hearing in the news. Narcotics are just illicit substances. So what we're talking about today is specifically the opioids and their related chemicals.
So some of them are made from the plant, and then some of them are synthetic.
Correct.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is not in my line of questioning, but as you're speaking, weren't they most of them always around, or some of them new drugs that we maybe didn't know how addictive they were? But some of the things that you mentioned have been around as long as I've been around, I think. So it's like, but now it's a national crisis. So is that accurate information that a lot of them have been here, but are there new ones that are just it must be horrible. We were talking a little bit off air that the impact, the devastating impact on people's lives and the addiction factor. So what is the, what happened? What's the difference?
Well, I mean, people have been using opium for centuries.
Right.
So that these compounds, chemicals are not new. What is new is some of the synthetics are fairly new, and they tend to be much, much more potent. So potency is something that we'll probably talk about again. But the impact of these medications when you take them on not only your pain relief, but your mental status, that euphoric feeling, is much, much more powerful with the synthetic compounds.
So is there a condition or an ailment, or like, it was it like a crisis of back problems? You know, what was the impetus behind this over-prescribing of the drugs? I am trying to get to what changed, because it was okay and now it's a crisis.
Initially, opioids were supposed to be advocated for cancer patients.
Okay.
And then the landscape changed because suddenly they were advertised as safe. And they even did a study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is probably the most respected medical journal in the medical field, that said the addictive potential was less than 1%. So there was all this reassurance to providers saying, oh, you know what, this helps with pain and it's not addictive. So suddenly people started to feel comfortable prescribing these medications. They've been around since the 1800s, but there wasn't widespread use. So suddenly it became acceptable, and the pharmaceutical companies did a fantastic job of advertising the safety around these medications.
So there you go. I mean, I really want to talk a little bit more about the drug companies and their complicitness in this. There's got to be some responsibility there. I mean, it's almost like they're pushers. I thought about that when I was preparing for this show. It's like they're drug pushers. And what's their role in it now? Like, who do they care? Is there anything going on where people are shedding the light on them, and even commercials are changing? Talk about the drug company's piece in this.
Well, before we go too far in blaming them, it was multifactorial. It wasn't just drug companies.
Yeah.
Physicians are definitely complicit. The insurance companies were too. I mean, there are a lot of different pieces to this puzzle. Purdue Pharma gets a lot of the press, and they were definitely a big piece of it, because when they introduced OxyContin, a long-acting, one of the first, I think, long-acting oral agents, it was advertised as being less addictive. And that turned out to be just not true. They actually paid a huge fine. They ended up paying over $600 million because of their false advertising. So they have been paying the price. To be fair, it wasn't just them.
No, you can't lay the blame at one place, because you're right, doctors have to prescribe it. And then I wonder, like some of my friends that have used OxyContin, they cannot wait to get off it because they know it can be addictive. So I wonder if that's like a developmental asset that they have, or if you're prone to an addictive personality. I don't even know if that's a fair question, but most of the friends that I have that have used it for really painful surgeries and, you know, implants and all that, they just say, I know I have to get off it. And they're not saying it feels bad, but they're very aware. So they're using their strength and their commitment to not using it. And obviously millions of other people are not.
I mean, the good thing is now there's awareness. And I've had patients that before surgery express concern, like, I don't want to get addicted. What can I do? I want to avoid these as much as possible. So the good thing is that before, I think there was so much social stigma about people that were addicted to drugs, that people didn't talk about it. Now there's this heightened awareness, and people are much more knowledgeable that it's a real problem and it can affect anyone.
And that's so true. I mean, it is a real problem, but it is also a disease. And anybody who knows someone who's addicted probably realizes that it does run in families. There is a genetic
component. Wonderful thing to say.
We don't understand much about addiction, and that's part of what's going on as a result of this crisis, is there is more research going on into addiction, but it does run in families, and it's not just a behavioral component. There appears to be a genetic component to it, too. I think everybody knows that that happens in alcoholic families, but it happens in other addictions, too.
Absolutely, and it should be treated as a disease. I agree with you. And we were talking a little bit off air about how addictive it must be for people to risk everything. And, I mean, that's what real addiction is. They've lost their sense of judgment, and they need help. And I'm sure they didn't know it going in, what that feeling would be, and they were in pain, and it stops the pain.
Well, most of them get addicted from prescribed opioids. And so these are being prescribed by their physicians who they trust. So when they get a prescription from a physician, to me, it seems as if they're saying, oh, it's okay because a doctor prescribed this. And Dr. Cloth is right. I mean, physicians were a major contributor to this as well. I mean, we take an oath when we're in medical school, do no harm. And that is, for us, we don't want patients to suffer. We don't want them to have pain. And so they were prescribed, and they were prescribed in excess.
I talked a little bit before about my addiction to Ambien. And it's not an opioid, I know that, but I really took it for years and started to have behavioral changes. First of all, I was exhausted all the time. All I wanted to do was sleep, and it was part of that. A doctor prescribed it to me, so I loved her. She was my friend, and I thought, well, it must be okay. She ended up getting off it, and then when I went back to a visit, she said, I'm not giving this to you anymore. It's bad for us. But that was an authentic conversation. But you're right about that trust factor. I mean, we are just raised to trust our doctors.
And there is a lot of confusion in prescriptions, because you get something like an antibiotic and you get the instructions, you must take the whole course of this medication.
Right.
And so people may assume that if they get a prescription for pain pills, they have to take them all. And that's usually just not the case. So I think there's a little bit of confusion that happens just from instructions too,
that's
or lack of
them. Excellent point. It is our mindset. If you're taking something for an infection, take the whole thing so you make sure it's knocked out of you. When I read the most current research, it does say still about 115 people are dying a day, and it's going up. And my confusion for that statistic is there is lots of press about this. I wish there was as much press about climate change and global warming as there is about the opioid crisis, because it's a really bad one too. But the opioid crisis is not being swept under the rug. It's get a lot of media attention, and certainly the attention of the medical community. How can the number of deaths be rising? Has it gone rogue? Is it, off market that people are getting it because they're so addicted? I really don't know that part.
Well, prescription rates have gone down. So the number of prescriptions that are being written for these medications has gone down to the level that it was at in 2006, which is still really high, but they are decreasing. Part of the problem, as far as I can tell, is just the problem with the addiction itself, because opioid addictions tend to be much harder to treat and more likely to relapse than other types of addictions. So part of that may be just due to this particular addiction. It's not going to go away anytime soon.
What about doctors? Like, as doctors, what's the discussion among, your anesthesiologist? This is a big deal. Doctors in general, and you interface with many, many other doctors, is there a sense of responsibility to address it and to be more careful? Not just mandated, but I'm talking about an authentic sense of, we really have to be a part of this. Or is it, there are all kinds of doctors, let's be honest, those that really care deeply. Sometimes the system is jamming them to see someone every 5 minutes. So what's the sense, if you have the answer to that, about where doctors are on this? Is there any research, or even your sense being in the community?
I think there's a lot of resistance now to prescribe opioids. There are some clinics and practices that refuse to do it whatsoever, and because the guilt, and also, chronic pain patients are very difficult. And as a result, these patients suddenly have lost the means of getting these prescriptions legally, And so now they have to go to lethal drugs such as heroin that, you know, are much more potent and may lead to be laced with more powerful, potent drugs that are even more deadly than heroin.
So it's a lot of it has gone underground. That's what happens. So there's illegal drug trafficking, so to speak.
There's a black market for all those excess drugs that people keep in their house, too. I mean, the amount that you're prescribed, 10 to 30% of people actually use only that amount, 10 to 30%. So the rest of it, they just keep
in case
as reservoirs.
Who doesn't?
Yeah,
I mean,
just
it's like
for
I
just
have a pain
case,
pill. I'm keeping
exactly.
it if my ankle hurts again. Yes.
You know, and most, it's the statistics have shown that patients continue to take it 3 to 6 months after their post-operative surgery, surgical pain has resolved. So they either become tolerant or dependent on it, or their family members get a hold of it, gets on the black market. So
when you say that doctors are not prescribing them, there's the flip side to that where people legitimately have incredible pain. So then what happens? Like, is there something else that you can prescribe? Because some of the people that I know that have taken some of those drugs, they needed them almost to survive through what their surgeries were or what their condition was. So if doctors don't, that's the flip side. What happens then?
So at TMC, the surgeons that we work with are really being active in finding other ways to treat pain.
Got it.
So we are seeing a lot of use of long-acting local anesthetics. Our group is providing long-acting local anesthetics for nerve blocks for certain orthopedic surgeries.
So does that mean when you get the procedure, it stays in your body longer?
Right.
Okay.
Right. So to numb up a body part, whether it's your abdominal wall or your shoulder, for an extended period of time, up to 3 days after surgery, get you over that acute inflammation part of it so that hopefully by the time that wears off, you need a lot less pain medication. But we're also seeing surgeons who are aggressively prescribing medications even before surgery. So you come in, you arrive in the pre-op area, and they give you a set of pills. And often that'll contain an anti-inflammatory medication, acetaminophen, and we're seeing an increased use of medications that are commonly prescribed as anticonvulsants. But I think we shouldn't really think of them as anticonvulsants because that steers people away from using them. What they really do is calm nerves. So all the irritation that you get in a nerve fiber from an injury like surgery is calmed by these medications to help decrease especially chronic pain. So these are really valuable medications that we're seeing used more and more. So I do think that there is a big response in certainly our local community. People do care, and they're trying to do whatever they can to help their patients through this as comfortably as possible.
You, to me, one of the most like big light bulbs that went on with me and will make me understand it a lot more is our addictive personalities. And if that's your thing, that it's going to be pills, that's an addiction. And so I understand. And doctors don't know that when they're prescribing someone to keep them out of pain. So there's a lot going on there in terms of, you know, the doctor's responsibility and knowledge, and the patient might not even know it till they get their first pain pill. Mm. Isn't that fair to say?
And I also think there's more realistic conversations about what you will experience. I mean, pain is a part of the healing process. When you have surgery, you have an injury, that is your body's mechanism telling you that you're hurt. And it's telling you that as the days go by, the pain gets better because your body is healing. And when you use opioids, it totally blocks that. But it also, you know, causes other side effects. You get dependence, you get tolerance. And what kills people is the respiratory depression from it.
Explain to me what that is, the respiratory depression.
People will stop breathing. That's what kills people.
So these medications are really, we call them unclean in that they don't target their point in the body exactly. So there's no one pain receptor that's blocked by these medications that causes you to not have pain. They block multiple receptors around the body, including those that affect pain, but also they activate receptors that cause the euphoria and the nervous system effects, but they also block GI, so that's where the constipation part comes in. The respiratory depression is a different area of the brain, and so that's where all of these other dangerous and unpleasant side effects come in because they they block so many different receptors instead of just pain.
And that was one of the questions I was going to ask you. How do you go from taking a pain pill and taking more pain pills and dying? I mean, don't some people live for a very long time taking them? Obviously, these kind of drugs are having an impact that are killing you. So we are going to take a short break, so we'll hang on that thought. And when we come back, I mean, there's more to go into the subject and maybe some of the new drugs. And I want to understand, like if I get a Walgreens prescription and I go to Taos, New Mexico, they have everything in the system. Or if I go to Denver, they have everything in the system. And honestly, it's like, this is a thing. I can get my prescription at any Walgreens. So I want to talk about how that can be controlled. Everybody stay here with me. More about the opioid crisis in 30 seconds.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and SpeakUp networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for joining us and for being a part of it. For this hour, we're taking an in-depth look at the opioid crisis. As stated earlier in the broadcast, the misuse of and addiction to opioids, including pain relievers, heroin, and synthetic opioids, is a serious national crisis that affects the public health as well as the social and economic well-being of millions, and is arguably one of the most dramatic, complicated, and frightening crises facing our country today. So shedding some incredibly good light and explanations for how we got here and how we're addressing it as a country are Dr. Robin Cloth and Dr. Nissan Marietta, Old Pueblo Anesthesiology in Tucson, Arizona. And again, thank you both for being here and sharing your expertise. So let's go back to the dying part. Is it... And I don't even know if this is a fair question, because you said it's from they stop breathing. If you are taking opioids, is it a progression? Do you need more? And how does everybody die eventually if you keep taking them? I mean, does it really affect all of your systems that much? What's the outlook if you don't get off of them?
So with time, you develop dependence, meaning that you suddenly require these medications. Otherwise, you go through withdrawal symptoms. And withdrawal with opioids is very, very uncomfortable and can be life-threatening as well. You also develop tolerance, which means that you need an increasing amount to achieve the same effects. However, the respiratory depressing effects you don't develop a tolerance to that. So you may need more to achieve that euphoric feeling, but the same amount will still cause respiratory depression or cause you to become unable to breathe. And then a lot of people are dying because they mix these opioids with other medications such as benzodiazepines, alcohol, and that is just a potent,
literally a recipe for disaster.
Yes, it is.
So with opioids, you're not supposed to have alcohol when you take them?
You shouldn't.
Okay. And I was asking you about the ability to control any of it, wondering about if people shop for doctors, which used to be very easy because there wasn't integrated prescription systems. And I'm telling you, absolutely, when I go to Walgreens out of state, if I forget, I take Synthroid. Mm-hmm. And if I run out or I forget it, I can go to a Walgreens and they just look up my record because it's an integrated system for every Walgreens. Wouldn't that be a little bit harder now to do that, to shop for a doctor, to write another prescription? I mean, if you're addicted, you'll do pretty much anything.
I do think that doctor shopping has gotten harder. People who have chronic pain are often on a pain contract, so they have to sign an agreement to only get their medications from one place, and they're limited to a certain number of prescriptions or pills per month. So those sorts of things are helpful, but a lot of patients find them very annoying. They don't understand why they have to jump through all these hoops in order to get their pain relieved. The physicians are frustrated by it too because they have to register these prescriptions in that database. So it's a lot of work for everybody. I mean, I think everybody finds it very frustrating, but theoretically, yeah, I agree, it should make things harder to abuse, but one of the things that you need to realize, I mean, we mentioned it earlier, people save their prescriptions. Of the people that have a prescription, about 25% of them will misuse it, meaning they're not taking it in the way that it was intended. And of the people that misuse these medications, a huge majority of them are getting it from a family member or a friend. They're not getting it from a doctor. They're getting it from somewhere else. Some of them will purchase them from family or friends, but a significant portion of them, about 60% of people, will obtain it, get it from
somebody else's medicine cabinet. I have friends that have to guard that medicine cabinet as well. They have to hide their prescription drugs. So I understand that. And I want to have a sense for, is there a demographic? Is it affecting, you know, white males over 50 or females under 50? Who is it hitting the hardest? It doesn't seem to me that it's actually a lot of younger people, but I'm not the researcher on this. So do you have a sense for who's it getting? You know, the older you get, I'm just going to laugh a little bit here, a little humor into the show, the more need you might have for pain medication. There are some times when my sciatica is working, you know, really working its wonder through my body, and I would pretty much take anything. I'm not kidding. It hurts so much, and to get relief, and I don't. I get on the floor and do my exercises because that is really what relieves my pain. Pill much easier. Much easier. But older people to me might be more inclined to be having those drugs prescribed. But what do you know? Do you have a sense for the demographics at all?
So the highest is in 25 to 64 year old, and men are twice as likely than women.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a hugely white problem.
Wow. It's a big wow. I am not kidding.
There's no insignificant portion of people over 55. 3% of the deaths are in that demographic, but it's associated with lower socioeconomic status. It's associated with lower education. It's associated with other substance abuse disorders, mental health issues, obviously chronic pain. But this is 79%.
White men.
White.
Wow. That's a big shocker. I don't think that that's generally out there. And it maybe speaks to why I'm going to sound cynical, there's so much attention being paid to it.
Well, that has been raised a lot.
Thank you.
There has.
And thank you.
One of the speculations that I saw is that this is not terribly different in character from the crack cocaine crisis in the 80s and 90s. The difference is that was a young black population. This
right.
is a middle-aged white population. And part of the difference is if a middle-aged white person goes to a doctor and says, I have pain, I need something for pain, they're much more likely to get a prescription for it than someone of any other race. And
there it is. I mean, there it is. It's everywhere. And thanks for sharing that. It's another, you know, I did a show yesterday and we talked about white privilege, which I did not understand until I was almost forced to take a class and watch a movie on white privilege for a leadership training that I was getting, because I thought, well, I'm not prejudiced, and white privilege is not about that. It's just being born white, and you are born white, and you that comes with privilege, and you just affirm that.
Yeah, and you don't even realize it. The one good is that this is leading to research in addiction that will help everyone.
Yes, yes.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, it amazes me that it took us to this point to get all of this action underway.
And help people. That's what, I mean, they need help. It's not that they're bad people and they need to be punished, as is with the case with all addiction. Right. They need rehabilitation and they need ways to get to
but
get
it
off
doesn't
it.
Discriminate. I mean, we see all the time celebrities that had back surgery and they become addicted. And actually, the rising population are teenagers between the ages 12 and 17. They're getting them from family members. And
like taking them from family members, or they're in pain and they've been injured. Do you know anything?
I think it's they're taking it.
They're teenagers.
Just for recreational use, and then they get addicted.
And I think about the devastation. I talked a little bit earlier and would love to know, there is an economic burden. I don't know how they ever come up with these numbers, but they're, putting it at about $80 billion a year. And when you think about all the related costs, healthcare, loss of work, and all that, and what I think about is that doesn't begin to measure the devastation to families and loss of income to families, because it's really devastating to see a loved one having to go through this and maybe lose their job or not be able to, get up in the morning. And then there's death. That's pretty devastating.
And it's going to be a long-term impact, because there's already been an increase in kids going into foster care because of parents with addiction or guardians with addiction problems. There's a significant increase in babies born with a neonatal abstinence syndrome, meaning essentially the moment that they're born, they're withdrawing. And as Dr. Marietta mentioned already, the withdrawal syndrome from opioids is miserable. So imagine you're just born and that's your welcome to the world. I mean, this impact is going to last for a long time, because kids are being affected in ways that I don't think anybody anticipated.
That haven't even been measured yet. And I wonder if they're measuring that impact.
So the annual cost for the neonates born with this abstinence syndrome in 2012 was $300 million. And their average length of stay is 17 days longer than a neonate that was not born. So it's costly. And I do a lot of labor and delivery. It's really sad.
And when I was pregnant, I mean, my doctors wouldn't prescribe anything. They no drugs. I mean, even antibiotics were very questionable. I didn't get very sick, but mostly when you're on, I didn't have alcohol. It cracks me up because my mother was a really good mother, but back in the day, she smoked a pack of cigarettes a day and had martinis on weekends. But when I was pregnant, I was like, oh my gosh, I might hurt the baby. What are the long-term effects on children that are born addicted? Is it something that eventually they will be
They're
okay?
pretty resilient from my research.
Okay.
It's pretty amazing, as long as they don't have any other factors such as being born preterm. But, I mean, I think they just have to get through that withdrawal period, which is not pleasant.
Oh, and I wonder if it makes them more, a possibility for addiction in the future, if it makes them more of a target and a possibility if that's there. So that's cases where the mother is. So I guess there are families where both parents are addicted.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry to, that's...
Unfortunately, enough of them that kids are ending up in foster care.
I was also curious about, if you know this, and I'm asking you guys some very hard questions. I don't expect you to know everything about opioids all over the country, because it is a complex issue. But since you know so well the statistics for white males, which is so... It was so shocking to me I have to process that one, because it's just, it's very interesting. And you're right, access to doctors and access to medical care in this case it's devastating. But what about, are there areas of the country that you are aware of that there are more pockets of, or it's more likely to have, or areas that have a better handle on it?
I don't know that anybody's got a good handle on it, but there are definitely areas of the country that are worst. The Appalachian states are far and away the worst. The West New England area, there tends to be more trouble in large cities, but I think that's more of a population issue, because the rates of prescribing are actually highest in large towns and small cities. There are counties in Appalachia where there are enough prescriptions for every single person in the county to have a prescription for an opioid.
So do you think, this is just these questions keep coming in here to me. What about the alternatives? Are the drug companies in a really big hurry to develop drugs that are not as devastating? Because, I mean, it's going to impact their industry, and God forbid they don't want that to happen. I'm not a big drug company fan. But do you think that there's research being done? Because the bottom line is there is a legitimate need for pain pills and for a lot of these things in the healing process. Maybe less, maybe looking at alternatives, maybe it's a good thing. But is there any light on the horizon for the development of any kind of, you know, substitute?
So the opioid industry makes $13 billion a year. So yes, they had to pay a fine of $600 million, one company did,
which
but that's
one
a
day's
slap
interest.
In the wrist.
Yeah.
There are medications available to combat pain, and that they don't have they're not associated with withdrawal. They have a ceiling effect. But these medications are more expensive, and they're often not covered by insurance companies and drug companies, and a lot of them require that you go to a specialist, so it requires access and resources.
So I know this is a tough question to ask good doctors. My daughter came here from L.A., and she had an allergy attack that it was ridiculous how much she was sneezing. Like, it was ridiculous. You know, like 70 times in an hour. It was, she and her eyes were bloodshot, and she was stuffed up. So someone said, there is this Chinese herb that you can go get, and sent her to where it is on, you know, in our city. And she went and got it. And within about 3 minutes, she stopped sneezing. So then she told someone else, and it's a natural herb. Is there any, I feel positive about some of the alternative therapies that doctors are looking at and prescribing. In my case with sciatica, my doctor said there really isn't a pain pill for it. You have to go to physical therapy, you have to stretch, you have to, you know, do exercise. I really wanted a pain pill because it hurt and I couldn't sleep. It helped me. It helped me heal. So are there alternative therapies like that doctors can be educated about and helping their patients to use that instead?
Absolutely. I mean, some of the more mainstream ones, massage, physical therapy,
not
acupuncture.
Covered by any medical player.
Some are,
yes.
Actually.
And chiropractic care is even getting covered more. Yeah.
You have to be
careful.
The problem with all of them is you have to be careful because you don't always know what you're getting.
Do your homework.
And that's the big problem with some of the supplements. I have no doubt that many of them are effective. They haven't been studied in the way that we as Americans are used to having our medications
have them
studied. And there's also no regulation in the production. So supplements are regulated differently from medications. So you don't always know that what's on the label is what you're getting.
And a lot of times it's awful, especially in the area of supplements. They make all these promises and they're cheap fillers and there's sugar in them and on. So, I mean, that's really, and that's true. So we have to be really careful because of the lack of regulation. But when you talk about things like massage and acupuncture, those are things that I think are safer. And you know what I did? And, you know, it's kind of cracking me up. When my sciatica was at the worst, I went and got a massage. And not only did it helped with the healing because I wasn't, you know, leaning towards one side. So these things are really proven and they work.
Right. And I'm sure that people are wondering about everybody's favorite herb, marijuana.
Yes, yes. Thanks for bringing it up. What about marijuana?
And there's a lot of controversy around marijuana. There's some evidence to suggest that the cannabinoids, which are the one compound in the many, many compounds that you find in marijuana, have some medical benefit. And I'm sure that you have thousands of listeners who would attest to that. The problem, again, is in regulation, in distribution. You don't know exactly what you're getting because it's not vetted. There's a huge variability in active components. There are mix-ins. Our policy at Tucson Medical Center, we drug screen everyone who uses even medical marijuana because it gets laced with other things. We've had patients come in who had cocaine mixed in with their marijuana. So naturally, they felt much better and had great energy.
Almost immediately.
But you really want to know what you're getting. And so that's the biggest problem is you don't know what you're getting. And until we can synthesize it to something that's consistently produced and consistently effective, I really worry about people using it because they don't know what they're going to get.
And it can harm them more. That's if you're getting marijuana with cocaine, your risk factors certainly go up, especially if you have an addictive personality. It's just interesting to me to discuss these things and to realize so many times in what I do, people ask me for answers about things, and it just comes up again. It's complicated. There is no silver bullet. There's no easy solution. We can't just mandate this or mandate that or get all the drugstores to talk to each other. It's a complex issue that's going to take a long time to address and to help. Like, the numbers are going up. It doesn't seem to me that it's, even though it's a crisis and there's a lot of education about it, there haven't been immediate positive results. So anyway, we're going to take another break. Some more questions when I come back. I have a lot of questions with Drs. Cloth and Marietta, and they've got amazing things to share about this opioid crisis, where we are, what we can do, and hopefully hope for the future.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everyone, and thanks for listening and for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. I am sure if you're listening today, you're glad you are, because we are all aware of the opioid crisis, what it is, how pervasive it is. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And for this hour, we are taking an in-depth look at the opioid crisis. And as stated earlier in the broadcast, the misuse of an addiction to opioids, including pain relievers, heroin, and synthetic opioids, is a serious national crisis that affects public health as well as the social and economic well-beings of millions. And it's frightening to me that more than 115 Americans die every day after overdosing on opioids. And I want to ask both of you doctors, is that not true? They're not dying from overdosing on opioids. It could be just from consistent use. Did I misspeak in making that claim? Or is it just, if you're using it consistently, are you going to have respiratory depression, as you called it? I'm a doctor now using the right clinical terms. But is my question making sense? Is it, do they overdose and take a lot more pills, so that's why they die, as with, you know, a heroin overdose? Or is it the consistent use, or is it both?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think most people that are misusing these medications, it's accidental. You end up, you know, I need one more pain pill tonight, and maybe I'll just take that with a shot of vodka, and maybe my allergies are kicking up, so I'll take a Benadryl. And it's an accidental sort of thing. But for any of these medications that they're getting illicitly from a supplier that's not known and trusted, then it may be an issue of potency. So some of the synthetic compounds that we talked about earlier, especially if you're getting them from an unknown source, these medications can be incredibly potent. And a number of the deaths that have been seen lately are heroin laced with fentanyl. And fentanyl is incredibly potent. And so if you don't know that it's there, what you think may be your regular dose can be lethal.
So talk about fentanyl and what it is and why it is killing people. What was it prescribed for?
So fentanyl was created for surgical pain. It's, I think, 50 times more potent than morphine. And now they even have an analog of fentanyl that's even
10,000 times more potent, carfentanil, and now people have, it's been created in China and has infiltrated the United States. And the dangerous thing about carfentanil is the reversal agent that people have, that police officers have or EMTs have on hand to reverse opioid overdose. It doesn't often work because it's so powerful.
It's literally an elephant tranquilizer. And the interesting thing, one of the interesting things about it is it wasn't even regulated in China until 2017. So it was getting shipped here and mixed in. And you would think that drug dealers would find a lethal compound in their medications to be bad for business. But apparently,
it's killing my customers.
According to the people that I've talked to, it's actually really good for business because then they know they're getting good stuff.
It's just a world that's tough for us to understand. I mean, it really is. And when we talk about it socially, you know, people describe it as chasing that high, that first high. And they just keep doing it, and it's harder to get that high. So that's pretty awful. What about, can you talk about what you two believe are some of the solutions? If there's anything in particular, protocols that you want to go into in a little more detail that are happening at TMC, it's obviously not as simple as getting doctors to stop prescribing them. So what are some of the solutions that you can talk to us about?
Addiction treatment is going to be hugely important. And unfortunately, only about 10% of people who need addiction treatment are getting it. And part of that is the insurance company's problem, because it's much, much harder to get those treatments covered than it is to get a pain pill. Medicare is a big problem with this one, because methadone treatment clinics, methadone isn't distributed by an outpatient pharmacy. You have to go to a clinic and get your dose and register that you've had it. Medicare Part D doesn't cover that. They don't cover any of those inpatient type treatments. So methadone is not covered by Medicare.
So that's not a solution. One of the solutions seems to me a lot of social activism and lobbying and leadership to come to people and say, this is what we have to do. And what happens at TMC? What kind of discussions are there? Are people going to conferences? I mean, I'm assuming it's a big, huge global discussion and all hospitals are involved in the conversation. That's a tough one.
That's a tough one.
No, but I really get it, because you hear about these commissions, and I'm like, what are commissions doing? How are they, you know, there's a national commission on the opioid crisis. How are they going to help? Because you bring up a very real baseline problem that impacts the lives of people who have an opioid addiction and whose family are impacted. They need treatment. And not only if Medicare doesn't cover it, I was in the mental health profession for 35 years. In this state, you're out of luck for any of those things. It's underfunded. We would much rather put money in prisons, and that's a fact. We have lots of really great prisons with lots of heads in the beds. So it's a complicated issue that a commission can't really solve.
The president's commission actually made some really thoughtful recommendations.
So talk about that.
And those are available. The whole report is available online. And I was actually really impressed with the recommendations that they made. The NIH and Department of Health and Human Services also have their priorities. So there's a lot of things getting started as far as what's actually happening. I think from what I've seen, it's mostly just prescribing limits. You know, people thinking outside the box a little bit and choosing alternatives. I don't actually know if any of the commission's recommendations have been implemented, but some of the things that they recommended were overseeing of insurance companies, making addiction treatments more available, covering more non-opioid services like the massage, acupuncture, those sorts of things, making those covered by insurance companies, and also changing expectations, changing the way hospitals are reimbursed, because one of the things that hospitals are judged on now is complete treatment of pain. So patients at TMC get a survey, and at the end of their part of their survey is, during your hospital stay, was your pain controlled completely during your entire stay? And that's a government requirement. And so the commission's recommendation was to remove that requirement because it's just not realistic. They understand that it is impossible to remove everyone's pain all of the time.
And you're promoting a culture where you're saying pain is not acceptable. Pain is a fact of life. And so when you say that that's not acceptable, then you're promoting this sense that, like, I must have zero pain.
All you have to do is watch TV, which I do a lot less of recently, and see the amount of commercials of the mindset of there's a pill for that. Sometimes when we're watching TV, we'll say, what was that pill for? It's so pervasive, and there are so many commercials telling you, this is going to make you feel this, and we're not even sure what it's for. So it's, you're right, it's a culture of zero tolerance for pain. There's a pill for that. You know, there's an app for that, but there's a pill for this.
I still think there's a big social stigma against patients that are on methadone and other reversal agents. This is, there's another one called Subutex or buprenorphine. And those are medications that are opioids, but they are long-acting. Their half-lives are a day to 2 days. And so you can take one medication and have pain relief, but you don't have withdrawal symptoms. And so it's very, very effective. But there are lots of... it's very difficult to obtain because you have to go to special clinics. It's expensive. So those things need to be available for everyone. And then I think there's still a sense of embarrassment. We're like, oh, she's on methadone. Well, actually, they should be lauded for that.
Right. Instead of they're still addicted.
Exactly.
They're on a journey.
Because people don't talk about people that are addicted to opioids, right? But then people, they're on methadone. It's prescribed, but they're a chronic pain patient.
Right. And it's really not a substitute addiction. It's not just that you're trying to treat you are treating the addiction. You're not substituting your oxycodone addiction with something that's just longer acting. You're really not. You don't get that euphoric effect. You don't get the high from the buprenorphine or the methadone like you do from some of the others, certainly much less than heroin or fentanyl or any of those synthetic analogs. But you're managing the withdrawal symptoms and reducing the cravings. And those are the components that lead to the problems with addiction, is people that do things that they wouldn't normally do to avoid those cravings, to avoid those withdrawal symptoms.
So, you know, I sit here and I think about doctors that we expect to be miracle workers, and everybody does. The body is a complex organism. There are so many things that can go wrong. Is a piece of this going to have to be the almost re-education of doctors so that they know, look at how much you have shared with us about what alternatives there are, about dispelling the myth about methadone? Is there part of this process to educate doctors who are prescribing these, who want their patients to heal, who don't want their patients to be in pain, of educating them about alternative therapies? Not that it's necessarily in place, but is it something that you would recommend or think is a good way to move forward? Here you are on national radio, and you can pontificate or say, you know, what do you think? What do you think, and how much would that help to re-educate doctors? Because you can't know everything, especially if you're, you know, a heart specialist or OBGYN or, you know, you're an allergist. How do you know all of these things, and how do we get to where physicians are aware of what they can do to relieve pain and not do it?
Well, clearly, ongoing education is
especially with
incredibly
this.
Important for all kinds of things. I mean, we have constant stream of breakthroughs. Every specialty has this, where we have to keep up with what's going on, but we also need to keep up what's going on in the community, because I really think that everyone, in the same way that, you know, the police officer that you run into on the street is sort of an ambassador for the city, I mean, I think that we are all ambassadors for good health. So there are certain things that we're sort of obliged to know about, and things that can make the community healthier should definitely be included in that. So I do think there's a lot of room for improvement. We are all required to do continuing education, and there are some states, for instance, when the HIV epidemic came about, certain states required ongoing education, a certain amount of continuing education credits for physicians to maintain a certain knowledge, even anesthesiologists, we had to do 2 hours of HIV research every year. And maybe something like that would be useful for everybody who needs to maintain a license in any state, not just Arizona, to make sure that we're maintaining a baseline
education, yeah, understanding of what's going on. What about, I would like to ask you, how has it impacted your lives personally or professionally? I mean, you're out there. You're working with patients every day. You're in a very well-respected practice. You're an anesthesiologist. How has it impacted your approach or your thoughts or, you know, like your personal journey? Has there been something you can measure there?
I think we, as anesthesiologists, have been more proactive in doing things to help with preemptive analgesia. So if I can put a nerve block in a patient before they have surgery, and that's, you know, injecting or numbing up the nerve that supplies the extremity or the abdomen with local anesthetic to numb it up so that the worst day for pain is always the first day, then I try to do that so that to do opioid sparing modalities such as things like that. And I always have very frank conversations with my patients nowadays, and I always point out, you know, yes, you will have pain and you will be prescribed opioids, but there are side effects to that. A lot of the times I feel like the younger millennial patients, I'm like, oh, I don't want to have any pain. Well, you will have pain, you know.
Gut it up.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just kidding. It's like, no, it's like, you're looking at the queen of no pain.
I mean, yeah. I don't understand how our country is so different in terms of the expectations we have. I mean, in Asia and Europe, patients have a surgery and they're prescribed NSAIDs and Tylenol. And here, and it's probably the promotion of this thought that it's just not acceptable to have
there's
pain.
There's a pill for everything.
Yeah, there's a pill. There's instantaneous gratification.
Everything.
Rather than working to heal your body or building your muscle strength back, just take a pill.
Right. I keep getting headaches. Take more pills. Or I keep getting headaches. What's causing them? I mean, most people, like, there's a pill for everything. And I feel as though in my world, there is much more of a resistance to that. With me and with my children, in general, a lot of my friends, it's like, just suffer a little bit and maybe the headache will go away. You don't have to take a pill at the first, you know, bit of pain. I think there's something to be said for that. And I wonder about, you know, in our world, we have these messages that we give to kids in schools. And I've thought about this a lot because I wanted you both to come back. I wanted to understand it more. I wanted to go more in depth with what it is a national crisis. And it's devastating to families and to economic futures and all of those things. At what point, you know, in the environment, one of the things that's helping to shift consciousness around global warming are truly teachers in schools. They are bringing it into the classroom. The kids are bringing information home. There's a lot of environmental groups that are wanting to partner with schools. Since this does impact millions of children, at what point do you start trying to educate kids and put it into that system to give them some tools to be aware and cope? I mean, would it be a high school student? At college, it's too late. But where would you, I mean, you both have experience. Where do we start with what I call the prevention piece? It's something we always forget. We're always in the treatment mode in this country in almost everything, not in the prevention mode. With mental health, with physical health, we treat problems. We don't work on prevention. It's the most underfunded of every budget in the state of Arizona. Trust me. And I was in social services for 35 years. And we'd go and say, if you do prevention, this study shows, you know, your prisons will be far less full in 20 years. And what they funded was, you know, treatment and the criminal justice system, but not prevention. So do you think there's a place down the road for educating kids at some level that this can happen?
I think no question. I mean, we have seen a spike in hospitalizations for kids related to opioids. It's little kids that accidentally get into pills, and then it starts again at about age 12. So I think you've got to catch them no later than middle school.
That's shocking to me.
Well, that's...
It's great.
It's the age that kids start to experiment and
right.
spread their wings, and if they are into danger, that's when they're likely to try something. So I think that middle school would be the absolute latest you'd want to start it. But I also think it would be nice to have more resources for parents to help make sure that they understand how to protect their kids, how to secure these medications and their other medications. But definitely awareness for kids, maybe sixth or seventh grade. It's got to start soon.
Wow, but that's great. You're right. After that, even in the criminal justice system, after that, they're pretty much gone. The statistics are pretty sobering, especially with success in education. If you don't get them by sixth grade, the percentage of kids that drop out, if they're not reading at grade level and all those things, it's after sixth grade. They start literally to drop out. So we are at the end of the show, and thank you both. You're both busy, and you have to take time from your practice to come here, and I appreciate it. And the show will be heard by hundreds of thousands of people, and hopefully some answers for them. July 17th, Paul Saginaw, the company with a conscience, and I can't wait to share with you what he has done with a company called Zingerman's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Make it a great green day, everybody. Thanks for being a part of my world.